Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Richard Spencer. We're going to be discussing the current ongoing crisis in Europe, some of the topics regarding the elections, and plenty more. Richard, it's great having you back on.
Sure. Well, thanks for inviting me.
So there's a lot of stuff going on in Hungary right now, and you were in Hungary, and you had an interesting experience there, and you recently uploaded your prison podcast that has been, I guess you what happened is you lost the file and you just uploaded it now.
Yes. Yeah, if anyone's interested, you could find it at radixjournal.com and then just go to the podcast page, or you could search for a podcast from a Budapest jail and you'll get it. Yes, I recorded that shortly after I got back from Hungary after being arrested and then deported from that country for thought crimes, effectively. I was declared a national security threat by Viktor Orban. And I feared that the file was lost forever because it was damaged, but I was actually able to repair it through a process I won't go into. So if anyone is interested in that adventure, that's definitely the best place to go because everything was fresh in my mind and it was a very interesting podcast. But yeah, it's interesting when I look at Viktor Orban now, I definitely have a different impression of him. I certainly had heard news about people in the West and Western Europe and America accusing Viktor Orban of being a fascist or a right-wing extremist and all the usual stuff. But my impression of his actions a year ago with regard to me and our conference was that maybe some of those accusations were true, but the fact is he really acted in a thoughtless and he thoughtless manner, and he did actions that were unnecessary. There was no need for him to overreact in the way that he did and declare, issue travel bans and declare people national security threats. It was just absurd. And he was basically reacting to left-wing politicians who were pushing him, and he basically did their bidding for them. He was backing down. There was no reason for him to do it. He could have very easily just said, well, we have a freedom of assembly as guaranteed by the Hungarian Constitution, so I'm not going to do anything. They're foreigners. I don't support them, but they are here. It's Hungarians can freely attend the conference where they can hear ideas. That's guaranteed in the Constitution. He could have easily just punted in that way, but he didn't. And so he made me and some others look like martyrs. He made himself look like a cartoon figure of a fascist. It was just a stupid move on his part in terms of PR, in my humble opinion. We had warning. I mean, we had about a week before the conference, not Viktor Orban, but a member of the Interior Ministry or something like that had said, like, this conference shall not take place. Of course, the conference did take place because governments are, usually, generally speaking, kind of incompetent. But then there, there's a travel ban issued against me and other people. I mean, we and all the people involved and most of our people who were outside watching it supported us in the sense that we are not doing anything wrong. We are not breaking a Hungarian law. You're just basically creating arbitrary travel bans. This is, I don't know if we can curse on the podcast, this is BS, and we're going to stand up. I mean, we are morally in the right. So anyway, I'm very proud of what we did and how everyone behaved. But there were warnings. I mean, we were effectively challenging him because I felt that what he was doing had no basis in law or justice. I think it's good to challenge people like this. This is, Martin Luther King challenged people. You've got to challenge him. And I don't know how anyone can claim that he won. He just looks kind of like a fool. He looks like he's overreacting and he's doing the left's bidding. It was not good. But I'll put all of that aside because I could disagree with someone's action, but not think that they're necessarily a bad person. I would say that among elected officials, Viktor Orban has been the boldest in his words and even in his actions in facing down this refugee invasion. And so I will actually give him all the credit that he deserves for that. He seems to genuinely care for the people of Hungary. And actually, if you look at his statements where he would say, you know, is Europe going to be for Europeans, so on and so forth, he seems to genuinely care about the people of Europe. And again, I don't put a lot of trust in any of these politicians and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, I mean, of elected officials, he has been the best. There have been some other people who have said things who are, you know, either not in power, like Marine Le Pen, or they're journalists or intellectuals or activists who have said things that are stronger and more radical. But in terms of elected officials, he has been the best. And so I will give him the credit that he deserves. I think he might very well have done something that was a little stupid with regard to, you know, our conference. But I think, you know, he might be one of the best politicians looked at from our perspective, that is an identitarian perspective.
I know during the interview, Jack Donovan was kind of teasing you, but you said relatively you were treated humanely.
Oh, I was treated, yes, I was treated humanely. I was actually, at the very beginning of the process, again, we're going back a year, when I was taken by these police, I knew that I was not going to be killed or something like this. But it did cross my mind generally of, oh, these guys might kind of want to rough me up or something. Like this, we're in Hungary, I'm a foreigner, you know, that might happen. And so that I feared that. I was willing to suffer. I was willing to undergo such treatment, but I certainly would prefer not to. But actually, shortly after being arrested, say, you know, an hour in, I could actually tell a few things, and that is that the police did not take this event particularly seriously. I'm not talking about, because remember, there was when they were surveilling me since I entered the country, and so they sent a large detail. There was, gosh, at least maybe two dozen people, some uniformed police officers and those who were out not in uniform who were directing them. And maybe the people who were in charge were quite serious about this, but the actual policemen themselves were young. I don't think they were really interested in sending a message. They were just doing their job. You know, I was shipped, you know, I was put in vans, I was shipped to various facilities. There was a lot of sitting on hard benches, not being able to sleep for, you know, more than 24 hours. I think it's probably like 36 hours, actually. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff, but, you know, it was nothing like being physically abused or anything like that. And actually, as I mentioned, once I was actually put into the immigration offices, one of the persons there who was not a policeman felt sorry for me. He actually let me out of the holding cell at one point. I was in his office. And I remember when we were talking and he told me that I had been declared a national security threat. We both just laughed. And so I think that there were some people who were, you know, aware of the absurdity of the situation and who were not really, they could tell I'm going to simply submit to the fact that I was captured and that there was no need to do anything else. So anyway, the prison itself was humane. I mean, it was basically boring.
But you get all these journalists, a lot of journalists, like in the New York Times, would probably describe Hungary as a really barbaric and backwards country, but I'm sure people are treated much worse in New York City jails.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just New York City. I mean, I would say most all big jails where there's tons of illegal immigrants, there are tons of African Americans, so on and so forth. I have no doubt that those are dangerous places, much more dangerous than the detention center prison thing that I was held in. It was nothing like that. I mean, there were actually a lot of Asians with me for reasons I don't quite know. Generally speaking, it was simply boring. I never feared for my life or anything like that. Postmodern, pro-feminist, liberal America has much more dangerous prisons than fascist Hungary, that's for sure.
It just it just points out the hypocrisy of the American establishment on human rights issues at so many levels.
Yeah, real quick, just think of the amount of men in general, but also the amount of white men who have been brutally raped in prison, and oftentimes brutally raped by Africans. I believe that people should serve time. I don't think we should abolish prisons or anything like that. But that being said, one could make a very strong argument that prison in America really is cruel and unusual punishment. It is not simply about serving time, quote unquote, you know, taking away part of your life so that you should think about your act. I mean, that's, you know, what prison should be about. It is in this country often about being raped and humiliated. And that is cruel and unusual punishment by most everyone's standard.
Is that an American phenomenon, or does it happen in places like Eastern Europe as well?
Well, I'm sure that kind of thing happens in all. I mean, I'm sure it happens to some degree in all prisons. I'm sure, you know, Mexican jails have a reputation for being like a jungle, and I'm sure that's true. But let's just focus on the American context. When you say you're going to serve 5 years of prison because you robbed this convenience store or something, I think most people can agree that's a strong but appropriate punishment. But I don't think anyone would agree that, yes, because you robbed a liquor store, you're going to be raped repeatedly and demeaned for 5 years. I mean, I think people would consider that to be something like a circle of hell. It's kind of
accepted by the public as part of the punishment.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's a kind of implicit sadism that goes on with this. And again, we're just talking about the hypocrisy and the kind of little lies that we tell each other, tell ourselves.
Theme of moral hypocrisy, I think it also ties in with the refugee crisis, because the same politicians who are saying that we have to let in these refugees because they're suffering and we need to do the humane thing, they're the same politicians that are responsible for a lot of horrible atrocities in these countries like Syria, the same politicians that are supporting these rebels that are committing genocide and driving these people into Europe. And it's the same. I know the argument made by leftists, a lot of leftists will say, because we support these horrible foreign policies in the Middle East, we're morally obligated to take in refugees. But I think it's important to point out that the same individuals who are the biggest supporters of open borders are also the biggest warmongers. I mean, just look at like George Bush, Jeb Bush, John McCain.
John McCain. Yeah, absolutely. I've even heard the argument that we should now invade Syria in order to stop the refugee crisis. I've heard that from a number of different sources. This is kind of like the so-called broken kettle logic. I've mentioned this on my own podcast a number of times. There is a story about someone who borrows a kettle from his neighbor, and then he brings it back to his neighbor, and the kettle's broken. And the neighbor says, you know, especially, what happened here? And the guy says, well, I never borrowed the kettle from you, and also the kettle's not broken. Oh, but also the kettle is broken, but it was broken before you lent it to me. And it's that kind of broken kettle logic. I think it's you can see that a lot in the American establishment, which is, you know, we want a regime change in Syria. We're going to destabilize Syria. oh, gosh, we've created all these unintended consequences. Well, we now need to do what we always wanted to do, that is a regime change in Syria, because of all the bad things that have happened while we've tried to create a regime change in Syria. It's just broken kettle logic. Yeah, I mean, in a weird way, I kind of understand what a leftist is saying when he says that because your foreign policy is so bad, you almost deserve this refugee crisis. I don't agree with that, but I actually understand that perspective. And just the idea that this comes out of nowhere is ridiculous. It obviously is coming out of, it's being at least catalyzed by geopolitics. And also, it's being catalyzed by our unwillingness to work with people. France, Germany, the United States, they're all very excited about overthrowing Gaddafi. Well, if you take Gaddafi at his word and you actually look at his actions before he was overthrown by the liberals, the fact is Gaddafi was well aware of what you could call the rising tide of color. He was well aware of the racial components to geopolitics. He understood that he was a kind of dam between Africans and a European and Europe. So he was a dam stopping an African invasion. And he understood this, and he was willing to work with the West to stop that possibility. And this is the man who was overthrown because, of so-called human rights violations, or we don't like dictators, we want democracy, all that. Like, if sensible people were in charge of countries, you're going to have to work with people who aren't very nice, who aren't democratic, who don't uphold your values. And you're going to have to work with them, and you're going to have to find common ground and see how you actually have mutual interest. And that easily could have been done with Gaddafi. I mean, Gaddafi was never an ally of the West or anything like that. He was his own man, and he's someone you could work with. So, when this dispensation that we're living under now is over, we're going to have, hopefully, leaders that are much more willing to work with people, much more willing to say, you can have your own country. I'm not going to dictate what goes on internally. And in terms of externally, that is in terms of geopolitics and foreign policy, we actually can work together. I would also add, just in terms of the refugee crisis, what I find fascinating about this whole thing is that it very quickly becomes a sensationalist moral issue. And so, whether it's the Alian, who is this, dead child on the beach, and oh, we need to shed tears over all this, or other things, it quickly becomes this media sensation, and it becomes this moral thing. So, effectively, Germans are undergoing the next stage of denazification, which has never ended. It started in 1945. It is not over. And, as I was speaking with Manuel Ochsenreiter on my podcast, in Germany, you can't even say things like, are there going to be bad consequences to letting in all these refugees? Is there a limit? And apparently, over the weekend, it seems like they might have actually reached a limit. But if you start saying things like, what are the consequences of this? You are shouted down as a Nazi. You are censored, effectively. And you were just not treated as having a legitimate perspective, because this is a moral issue in their minds. You must accept these non-Germans and really non-Europeans, non-whites.
Interesting thing about Manuel Ochsenreiter, who I've also interviewed several times on my show, he's the only person to chronicleize this issue from both ends of it. He's done extensive journalism in Syria, and I definitely recommend anyone listening to who wants to understand the Syrian crisis to listen to those older podcasts I did, because it's important to point out a lot of it. People just want to do this sort of feel-good, moralistic stuff that makes them feel good about themselves, like they're doing something, but they don't actually understand the root causes of these problems. And the same people who were outraged, morally outraged by the drowning, are the same individuals who were who are saying that we need to invade Syria and we need to arm the rebels.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And then also, like, you start crying all these crocodile tears over one child. It was an unfortunate accident. You start crying all these tears. We need to open up all our borders because of this one incident, apparently. They don't cry tears when a bunch of rebel thugs execute Gaddafi, who was a leader of a country. They don't cry tears when they, you know, in order to bring democracy to Iraq or overthrow Saddam, that the consequences of these military actions are that somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people have died. That's apparently okay, because it was, you know, Samantha Power okayed it or something like this. You know, it was done with the best of intentions. The West was trying to bring light to these benighted regions. You know, that's fine. You can kill 1,000,000 people. But then there's one child. You know, it's very unfortunate. This one kid washed up on the beach. We have to destroy our nations because of this.
I think it was Stalin who said that one murder is a tragedy, 1,000,000 murders is a statistic.
Right. I'm not sure Stalin actually said that. That's probably attributed to him. But yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, I've noticed that almost every interesting quote is attributed to Churchill. You know, it's like, I conquered. Oh, didn't Churchill say that? No. you hear that. I've noticed that. But I'm not sure Stalin actually said that, but there's a certain truth to it, where all of these deaths that have been created as a consequence of these horrible actions in Iraq are just kind of not in the public consciousness, but this one image of a child washed up on the beach is seared in the public consciousness. And yeah, it's how things work. The fact is, because human beings aren't rational animals, and I think this is, we really have to understand that if you're going to understand, I guess, really anything about reality. The frontal lobe, the site of reason in our brain, is a very late evolutionary development. Our reptilian stem that is, you know, in the brain, and our mammalian system, those are much older. They're much more efficient. They're much more powerful. They are effectively on all the time, whereas our rational system is, you kind of have to focus it and it gets tired. You know, like when I'm giving this podcast, I'm being rational, but you know, most of my existence, I'm not, you know, focusing in logically on something. So basically, things like our fight or flight mechanism or our mammalian system, which is kind of like our social mechanism and site of emotions and things like fear, hatred, envy, lust, you know, love, ambivalence, all that kind of stuff. These things are much more powerful in our lives. So we don't, you know, so this is why some image of a child, it touches us, you know, it pulls on our heartstrings, it creates outrage, it creates all these emotional things. And emotional things are much more powerful than logical arguments or statistics. They're just infinitely more powerful. I mean, Alex Krutigish was one of the first ones to stress this, and I think tons of people, including myself, have picked it up after him. You know, you can bury someone in statistics about IQ differences and behavioral racial differences or the reality of evolution and so on and so forth. You can just bury them in books and stats and pages of numbers and blah, blah, blah. It does not make a difference when people are morally repulsed to the idea of race being important or even existing. They are morally repulsed to that you would think racially. And so it doesn't matter how rational you are. It just does not matter. And I think this has been proven out. This has been proven. I mean, you know, people like Jared Taylor, who will rationally present, you know, statistics proving race differences, you know, and I don't disagree with what they're doing. And I think what they're doing is important, but you know, they're going to constantly run up against this brick wall of morale, of this moral sense that people have. And
I think it is important to point out the moral hypocrisy of the of individuals and of the system and of American society as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, and we also, like, there's the moral hypocrisy, but also we've got to understand the modern world morally. I tried to do this a little bit, or I should say, I made a start at this project with my speech at the last American Renaissance Conference. I'm not really criticizing. Well, I am criticizing Jared, but I'm constructively criticizing him in the sense that, I mean, Jared is willing to hear these other views. But my talk at this last AMREN, I was really trying to get at that. What is the emotional and moral core of things like anti-white hatred or the emotional core of multiculturalism? Why do they hate us in the sense of why am I hated, in the world more than child molesters or murderers? Why is that? Why is it that the city council of Rotherham in England was afraid that they were so afraid to prosecute? Are so afraid to investigate all of these rumors of horrifying sexual violence done to their children because they were afraid that it might be done by Asians and Muslims and that they would be called racist. Why is it that the notion of being called racist terrorized them in their minds more than the notion that their own children were being raped? Why is that? There has to be some emotional, moral quality to this phenomenon, and we've got to get our minds around that. We've got to examine it, and we've got to try to appeal to people at some level on a moral or emotional way. This morality, as I understand it here, I'm not talking about how most people understand it, probably as biblical dictates or something, but this kind of morality and emotions, these are so much more powerful than numbers and reason.
So you've been also covering the election and Donald Trump. One of the things we talked earlier about the reasons why Republican Party and conservatism has failed, and it runs kind of contrary. Donald Trump's popularity runs contrary to that, to the reasons. But basically, what people perceive the conservative movement as being about is they see it primarily. They see it as being for the rich. Also, a lot of younger people who are secular are turned off by the religious right. And basically, you have an article about the conservative movement and how it's called "What Is the American Right?" And basically, it's a coalition of three groups. Basically, okay, it's a coalition of free market capitalism, or at least low taxes, as a moral and empirical good for all, generic Christianity, which gestures towards other presumable, compatible, monotheistic faiths as a foundation of patriotism, liberty, and human rights, staunch support for the U.S. military, with occasional criticisms of Washington's foreign policy, staunch support for the State of Israel, with unconditional support of its foreign policies, and values based on a conception of American history and identity.
Right. That is basically what I think the right is. A lot of people, even politicians, will effectively say this, with like, we've got to bring in economic conservatives. And what that means is, big business or billionaires or whatever. We've got to bring in national security conservatives, which basically means neocons or the military-industrial complex or, Christian Zionists. So on and so forth. And we've got to bring in the social conservatives. And I guess this means people who think Glenn Beck is a great philosopher and this kind of American Christianity, which is, that's a podcast all in itself. And I think what is fascinating, and then also this is kind of all the glue that binds all this together, is this American exceptionalism idea, which is a rather odd thing because it's both universalistic and chauvinist all at the same time. It's a notion that America has special responsibilities and special abilities in the world. That if France were to invade countries, we might declare them an empire, or chauvinist. But if America does it, it's okay, and it's our responsibility. So this certain kind of American exceptionalism, but at the same time, this exceptionalism is very different than exceptionalisms of the past, because it is actually not a belief in a special chosen ethnicity or a special, you know, the how the Germans are the greatest, or the French are the most civilized, or the Russians are the greatest. It's not that at all. It's a kind of universalistic idea where it's married to this notion that America is this haven for all the world's, you know, oppressed religious people to gather and, you know, explore their faith and individual liberty or whatever. It's that city on the hill that Ronald Reagan was so enamored with, and conservatives still are. That is basically conservatism. And I think it's important to get at these, again, as I was saying before, at these almost emotional or, you know, Weltanschauung type qualities to it, and not just to think of it as conservatism is a way that capitalists oppress the lower classes or something. I think that might have a kernel of truth to it, but it's not really true. You're not really getting at the social phenomenon. You're kind of copping out, as leftists
and
often
do. I think the appeal of Donald Trump is that he's not like, I'm not saying I don't totally trust Donald Trump. I think he's a wild card on one, but I don't trust him. But at the same time, the Republican establishment doesn't trust him either. So he is a force for good. And they're saying he's not a real conservative, he's not a real Republican, but in a lot of ways, I think that's part of his appeal. He is talking about, obviously he's famous for his immigration stance, but he's talking about things like raising taxes on hedge fund managers, taxing corporations that outsource jobs overseas. That's really what part of his appeal.
Well, I totally agree. I think that is part of it. I think there's a lot of different things that are dovetailing in the Trump phenomenon. And I'll just kind of go through them because it's all very interesting. And in a way, maybe you could say kind of contradictory, because I think in a way, Donald Trump is the last stand of the people who were attracted to the kind of conservatism that I just described. That he has this populist appeal. It's a, this man is not going to fool around. He's real. He's going to do, you know, it's a kind of backward looking movement that imagines that we can make America great again, and so on and so forth. So I think to a degree he's popular among them, but it's also worth pointing out that the organs, the major institutions and organs that have put forth this American exceptionalism that I described earlier, are really unequivocally against Donald Trump. I think it's more than they don't trust him. I think they are against him. And the fact that Donald Trump has shown that you don't need the conservative movement, you don't need National Review and all of its related organs. They can hate you, they can attack you, and you don't need Fox News. Fox News clearly, I mean, granted, they have granted him a lot of airtime, but Fox News clearly does not like this. And in that first debate where they basically announced after the debate with Frank Luntz that the Trump phenomenon's over because of this stupid focus group that I just did. I think that was clear that they maybe wanted to ride the Trump wave a little bit, but they did not want this is not what they want. And so you have that. You have the GOP effectively does not want Trump. The GOP, its major donor base, its establishment, they want, you know, Scott Walker or Jeb or whatever. They want Rand Paul more than they want Trump, even though Rand Paul's father certainly scared the establishment. So Trump is proving that you don't need these people. And I think also what you were getting at before, one of the reasons why all of these groups hate Trump is because he's a liberal. But all of these things, all of these issues on which Trump is a liberal are actually issues that most people disagree on which most people disagree with the Republican Party. I mean, you know, Trump wants to, you know, tax hedge fund managers. Trump once, you know, you can tell when you, like some of earlier statements, Trump probably would put together a kind of health plan where it would be like, you know, if I could do my Trump imitation, it'd be like, look, if you're rich, you don't have to use this stuff. But if you're having hard times, we're going to give you a 5-star health plan right here. That sounds more Brooklyn than Upper Queens. I apologize. Anyway, you get my point. Trump is just the kind of guy. He's not this just libertarian extremist. I think Trump also, and again, it's good to be skeptical of Trump, but I just think Trump, for all of his bluster and all of his outlandishness and kind of ridiculous qualities, and his, the fact that he is demeans, if you attack him, even like rationally, he'll just demean you as a loser. And I mean, all that stuff, which is kind of funny, but not really that admirable, to be honest. The fact is, I think he probably does actually care about white Americans in his heart. I don't think Trump is an evil sociopath or just simply a sociopath.
There was that one case where he did use eminent domain to take the house of an elderly widow to expand
the
casino.
Well, you know, that was very unfortunate, but, you know, that woman was paid money. It's not like he went and just took her house. And, again, I think, you know, look, I don't – it is what it is. It was not very nice, but I'm not going to really defend either side on that. I mean, this kind of thing happens. Trump, you know, I don't think you should look at that and say that Trump hates white people. I mean, he probably looked at that as some, you know, kind of crazy thing. Look, when I was at the University of Chicago, there are all these stories. University of Chicago effectively owns all this land, and there are all these stories of them, you know, kicking out renters and so they could build a new gym or whatever. Well, you know, it happens. It's not. You know, I don't know. It's not like he killed that woman or something. I mean, she was paid money, and she's, you know, I just, some of these conservatives, again, I just think this is also the stupidity of conservatives, where they focus on some story to pull your heartstrings about an old lady who was moved out so that they could build a parking lot. These conservatives have, their policies have directly led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, I mean, they're in no position to talk about stuff like that. So, anyway,
I think Trump phenomenon kind of reminds me of it. We discussed this, and when we discussed this, this was before Trump got in the race. This was back, I think, early spring. So it was before Trump declared. But we were talking about what kind of movements would be successful. And the Republican Party, it's always been sort of the Republican establishment says that if we're only for more open borders, we're gonna get more voters. But that, what type of movement that there should be is a movement, kind of a radical centrist movement that is opposed to mass immigration, that's opposed to outsourcing, that's pro-environment.
Yes.
That is economically populist in favor, that's anti-Wall Street, that is socially pretty much moderate. Trump doesn't perfectly fit that mold, but I think he is kind of tapping into something like that, and that's why he is becoming very popular. I mean, there's polls showing him winning general elections.
Oh, yeah.
I think he is,
and his negatives are lower
even
than Hillary's.
If you look, I think he can reach out to new demographics. I think he can win over a lot of working class white Democrats. I think there's polls showing him getting one quarter of the black vote even.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of all of, you know, I wonder if Trump was maybe listening to our podcast. No, I'm half joking,
well,
but maybe he was.
The thing about Trump is that he was involved back in 2000. He was involved with Ross Perot's Reform Party, and
yeah.
When he was considering running for election, and that's also Ross Perot is an example of that. He ran as like a radical centrist.
Yeah, you know, I seriously doubt Trump listened to our podcast, but I think he was listening symbolically in the sense that what we were saying were actually good ideas. I mean, conservatives don't really recognize their negatives. They'll always look at how, like, you know, oh, we, you know, this is our base because this, you know, leader of a megachurch told us it was, but they don't really look at, you know, the kind of negative things that they bring along with them. And I agree. I think Trump is basically tapped into the kind of positive things, the kind of the nationalism or patriotism, which are positive, just electorally speaking. But then he's really gotten rid of the stuff. I think one of the reasons why a lot of people would consider supporting him is that I don't think they really believe that he is going to outlaw all abortion. I think most people look at him as actually more anti-war than Rand Paul.
So, I don't think that Donald Trump is necessarily super pro-war. I mean, he was outspoken against the Iraq war. I think he
just has to go
along. But I'm saying with his rhetoric with, like, on the Iran deal, I think he sort of has to, because the Republican voters are brainwashed by Fox News. So on some issues, like on Iran, he has to go along with that.
Right. It's very easy to say that that was a bad deal, because you can just basically say, oh, you know, Kerry, he's what a schmuck. You know, I would have made a good deal with these Iranians. I would have got the Iranians to build the Mexico wall, kind of stuff. And and maybe he's right. Yeah, it's very easy just to say that. But the real question really is Trump more or less likely to bomb Iran or get into some kind of nuclear conflict in the Middle East? The fact is, the way I view it, if you just look at his positions as a private citizen, I think he's far, far less likely to engage in something stupid like that than Ted Cruz or Jeb Bush or all these people who seem to be true believers in neoconservatism. And so, I don't really want to look into the details of the Iran plan. I have better things to do. I think it's extremely unlikely that Iran, which has not started any wars in the past quarter century, the idea that Iran is some grave threat, I don't believe that. I think we should be dealing diplomatically with people. I think even if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, I think, you know, people think that they're just going to, that means the end of the world. Well, the fact is, if we look at history and not at, you know, the ravings of Pastor Hagee, that we basically could see that, you know, nuclear weapons are in many ways a terrible thing, but they've actually led to stability and smaller wars. And it's a kind of stabilizing influence of the 20th century. I'm not saying nuclear weapons are a good thing or a bad thing. It just is what it is. So, you know, I think we should deal rationally with Iran.
I don't blame Iran for wanting a bomb, because they're constantly being threatened. They're being threatened on both ends. They're being threatened by the United States and Israel, and they're surrounded by U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. But on top of that, they're also being threatened by these Saudi-backed jihadis as well. So they're totally, I mean, they're a minority in the Middle East, because they're Persian and Shia, and most of the Middle East is Sunni and Arab. So they have total rational reasons for wanting a bomb.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also we just shouldn't underestimate the degree to which people are actors, they're rational actors. This notion that there are these people who are in charge of the state that want to end the world, that seems to be the starting point for conservatives. Not that that is impossible, you know, hypothetically, but if you just look at the history of Iran, it has not started wars. There are Jews living in Iran. Like, if Iran was fanatically anti-Semitic to the, you know, where they are willing to die in order to kill all the Jews, I mean, why don't they start with Jews living in the country? Are these people being rounded up and murdered?
That's the thing. I mean, Christians are being genocided in the Middle East right now, and Iran's a country that's actually protecting its religious minorities, yet they're the ones who want to perpetrate a Holocaust.
Right. Who is more likely to deal rationally with a Christian minority population? Assad? You know, Assad, of course, Assad has done that in the past. Assad is a completely civilized man, leader. Assad is not going to engage in the destruction of Christian communities. It's ridiculous. The people who are going to do that are the ISIS and all these kind of terrible forces the United States has unleashed through its foreign policy follies. You know, I truly don't understand. I mean, America is, it's weirdly schizophrenic, because there are points with American foreign policy making where American foreign policy making can be extremely cruel and brutal and realistic. They can deal with awful people. They can deal with Saudi Arabia. They have certainly been involved in the establishment of dictators and, you know, terrible situations in South America. They can be brutally realistic. But they also have this idealistic strand to them about just strain to them about wanting to make the world safe for democracy that almost always unleashes forces that are against its interests, that are maybe, apparently, I think they are, maybe these are, this is part of their interests, that are against their interests, that are against Christians in the region, that are against just civilized people in the region, like Assad being foremost among them.
And, I mean, ironically, is this, Assad is far more assimilated, and Assad and his family, they're far more assimilated into European culture than the refugees coming into Germany.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's just, I mean, I'm sorry, can we curse on this program?
Sure.
Okay. Clusterfuck. It's not the only way to describe this. Maybe you could say it's a clustercuck. To combine the conservative meme with, it's just awful, and we're doing the worst. If we wanted to perpetuate a sane and reasonable world where we can actually get along with people, indeed, getting along with people who aren't your allies, that's the trick. Can you deal rationally with someone who is an adversary?
People
can't. They are creating
a chaotic world. Nick Griffin in England, who is an opponent of Muslim immigration in England, he went to Syria and also Lebanon, and he met with Assad, and he visited, like, the big mosque of Damascus, and all the mainstream media were, like, making fun of him. Why is this anti-Muslim guy going to a Muslim country and visiting Muslim leaders? And it just – people are so closed-minded in their thinking.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this brings us back to Gaddafi. I mean, Gaddafi was willing to work with Western powers to keep out Africans from Europe. You know, it's just like he was giving them a gift, and they decided to kill him. I mean, it's just, you just see the just lunatic nature of the people in charge of Western governments.
Do you think the United States should bring in the refugees from Syria?
Well, I of course don't support that. Although, again, I will admit, just simply because I'm open-minded, I almost agree with these leftists who think that we effectively deserve to do this. In a way, America does deserve this refugee crisis. But again, I certainly don't support it. I just think that there are just so many ways out that we can not try to destabilize Syria. Why don't we give that a shot? As opposed to doing the same thing that we've been doing. But again, it's a moral issue. I actually, this morning, someone tweeted at me this a Glenn Beck recent statement. I mean, Glenn Beck is just such a loon that you really can't parody him. I mean, if I were to try to parody...
Oh, he always does that fake crying routine.
Oh, he was crying again. If I tried to parody him... I would fail, because I wouldn't be willing to go as far as he goes. Yeah, but he was quoted, you know, quoting the, you know, this horrible Statue of Liberty poem about send us your worst. But he was basically like he was basically imagining America as this, you know, haven for the religious. We have to take them all in, and you know, this is God's plan, and we want to be on His side. This is why God built America. And I actually saw another, I'm just kind of going by association here. Someone, after I started talking about this on Twitter, someone sent me something from him that I had never seen before. And again, it was so beyond anything that I would come up with that I'm just dumbfounded, basically. But there's actually this lecture where Glenn Beck declared at Kufi, because I saw Kufi logo in the background, which is the Christians United for Israel, the Christian Zionist organization that has major meetings. But he was saying how George Washington created the United States in order that it might lead to the establishment of Israel in the Middle East.
What?
I mean, I'm literally not exaggerating. I mean,
does he genuinely? He probably genuinely believes it.
Yes, I know. I don't think a lot of people have suggested that Glenn Beck is kind of like a carnival barker, or you know, a showman who just come. And there, maybe that is the case. But oftentimes, you know, the best con man believes his own con. You know, the ones that kind of believe it in their mind, those are the ones that, you know, deliver the stuff with the most passion. And so I think he probably does believe all this nonsense. Anyway, it's just these people are just so beyond the pale. It's just so such an expression of the degeneration of society that anyone would take this person seriously. I mean, it's really pathetic and depressing. Anyway.
Oh, someone was pointing, made a comment with issue of Syria. Interesting to point out is in Latin America, Syrians actually immigrated there and became part of the elite in those countries.
Interesting. I don't know the history of that, but I would be interested in that.
In the United States, Syrians have done pretty well. But it's important to point out there's different, they're not the same people who are coming in now, like unscreened. The first wave of immigration are mostly Christians or people from the upper classes.
Yeah. Well, that's probably true. I would imagine that that's not occurring with Germany. I think one interesting thing is how these are all young men, mostly. I've seen statistics. I mean, again, I'm not there. I've seen statistics of 70-80% are effectively these young men. You have all these pictures that are being shared on Facebook and Twitter of someone who was in ISIS a year ago is now in Germany and taking a selfie with Angela Merkel, you know, all this kind
of
stuff.
And also,
you
have people coming as far. You actually have Africans pretending to be Syrians, pretending to be Syrians.
Yeah, it's a disaster. There's no other way to put it. It lasts forever. I mean, that's the thing. Is Angela Merkel really, does she secretly want, out of some kind of extreme sense of German guilt or maybe Christian millenarianism or something, does she literally want to destroy
that
the German people?
They're like her adopted sons because she's never, I mean, she's like in her 60s and she's never had kids.
Yeah, she's a weird woman. She's from this hyper-Protestant background her father actually immigrated to Eastern Europe, to Eastern Germany, which is rare. And she comes from that background. She doesn't seem particularly religious to me. She might be one of these cases where that religious zeal is expressed in other ways. But from what Manuel was telling me is that she's kind of this ultimate manager. She is a manager of German decline. She is able to bring in all these contradictory people and forces to her movement. Within the CDU, you'll have someone who's involved with Thiemann, and then you'll also have someone from Bavaria who's like, you know, hardline anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage, you know, Catholic traditionalist. They'll both be in the same party, and Angela Merkel will kind of play them off each other and have them both there, have two different constituencies. And it's all
another
the
thing
assumption
that's
that the good
interesting is most of the refugees are going to Bavaria, which has traditionally been the most conservative part of Germany. They're not going to Berlin.
That's true. Bavaria is closer. The geography might play a role. Bavaria is also a very well-to-do place, Munich especially. So they are just gravitating there. You know, Berlin is I love Berlin. It's a fun place. It's in a little more kind of depressed, you know, relatively speaking. So they're probably just going to the, you know, bright lights, big city.
And it's going to definitely, like, hurt. It's going to hurt the economy. It's going to stop a lot of tourism. Like, 2 million people usually go to Munich for Oktoberfest, and a lot of people are going to cancel their trips.
Oh, I would too. Although I myself would not, because I would want to almost see this happening. I've been tempted to go. I'm of course banned from the Schengen zone thanks to Viktor Orban, but I would be very interested at what's happening. But yeah, I mean it's it's just, again, just this permanent damage that is inflicted. You know, I spent a lot of time in Bavaria. I learned German in Bavaria, and I spent two summers in Bavaria. I spent many other months in Berlin as a student in various capacities, learning German and in other capacities. This is, 10 years ago now, a little bit more than 10 years ago when I was first in Bavaria. But when I was there the summer of 2002 and 2003, my concept of Bavaria was this, it's some places as just almost a dream, a place to live. I mean, it's a beautiful place. I was actually learning German in this small town called Prien am Chiemsee. And it was a town which, there's a lot of what we call social capital. It was a tightly knit community. It was a beautiful community. It had nice little shops and restaurants. You could go swim in the lake and look on to one of Ludwig II's castles that was in the middle of the lake. I mean, it was kind of like a dream of Germany. This is during the time of the Iraq War and the run up to it, and this notion that America was somehow conservative and Germans were decadent liberals or whatever, I just found the reverse was true. America to me was, was seeming like strip malls and mega churches, and Bavaria was this beautiful place. It seemed more traditionalist in the real sense of the word, not measured by how many people want to bomb Iraq. And it's just an idyllic place. The notion that 10 or 12 years ago, the notion that 10 or 12 years from now, it might be difficult to recognize is truly depressing. It's truly depressing. In a way, it is motivating. It shows us the importance of what we're doing. What we are doing is necessary. The people who just think that they want to, I want to have my job and go earn money and keep my head down and maybe I can have a house in the burbs. Well, that's fine, and I totally understand that. And most people are going to do that. That is okay. But our movement is necessary, and we need to stop these just terrible people who are destroying European heritage and culture. That they are terrible people, and they are the enemy much more so than these shitheads coming in from Syria are the enemy. You need to look at the Angela Merkels, and they are the real reason why these masses of morons are coming into these countries.
The people coming in, they're behaving in their own rational interest. Their rational personal interest is to better their own lives, so I can get that. But what really disgusts me is the people is the treason of people who are selling out their own country, their own societies and countries.
Yes, yeah, undoubtedly.
Time to wrap it up soon, but I want to add one last thing that's pretty funny about Donald Trump. Has culture left conservatism this post? Donald Trump's tweets said, and culture's tweets said, I don't care if Donald Trump wants to perform abortions in the White House after this immigration policy paper.
Yeah, I know. I saw that. I think I blogged about that, actually. Pretty bold words from Coulter. We'll see about that. And I think what I suggested there was, has Coulter left conservatism? Has she, in a way, gone too far that she won't be allowed back into the conservative party, despite the fact that she sells, tens of thousands of books and is kind of a superstar in that movement.
Yeah,
she
has a huge following
among
mainstream conservatives, so she's pushing the Overton window further out. I've noticed, if you go on a site like Breitbart, it's like the number one conservative website, and if you just read the comment section, they're starting to sound like your site, like Radix.
I agree. I agree, and I think we should be kind of open to that. I mean, there are some limits to something what Breitbart will do, and but I think we have to think about ways to try to channel that in our direction, because ultimately, Breitbart's not the answer. But I just think there's a lot of anger that amongst people that they don't really know a positive way to direct that anger. And I think maybe that's what our movement should be doing. I don't think we need to, you know, the negative stuff is real, but I don't think we need really to dwell on, you know, more examples of black crime or you know, some Muslim who raped someone or whatever. I mean, that kind of salacious stuff is real, but it's actually being done by the conservatives. And I think it's our job to really find positive outlets for this anger, to say, you know, how are we going to really solve this problem? Because voting for hardcore Republicans or something is not going to do it. So what do we really want from, you know, for our lives? And that's probably the task for our movement.
So, Richard Spencer, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Robert.